Intermediate Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Craig H. Nakamura, Alexa D. M. Fujise, and Lisa M. Ginos are presiding. Please be seated. Case number CAAP-12-858, State of Hawaii v. Yong Shik Mon. Jonathan Burge for appellate, Brian R. Vincent for appellee, Robert T. Nakasugi for amicus curiae, Attorney General, State of Hawaii. Argument on the merits.
Morning, everyone.
Good morning, Honorable Mayor Approach.
Counsel ready?
Yes.
Please proceed.
May it please the court. There's a number of issues, and they all surround the implied consent form used by the police, basically in every DUI case right now. I'd like to start off with the McNeely issue, unless the court has a different avenue to pursue. The McNeely case came out in April of this year, and basically the ruling in that case was that alcohol dissipation does not create a per se exigency. That's the holding. It's not just in a blood test, it's not just in a urine test, it's not just in a breath test. That's the whole, it's not a per se exigency. Now, exigent circumstances can still exist, and the courts can still take a look at the dissipation as a fact in the exigency. Now, in this case, the defendant or the appellant actually took a breath test. So it's different than the McNeely case where there was a blood test. And the attorney general and the prosecutor both argue that that case is a limited holding only to blood tests. The action the court took 2 weeks later in the urine case is telling that it doesn't apply just to that. Basically, it applies to DUI cases, and it applies to all DUI cases. Now,
isn't the McNeely case outside of the implied consent statute? In other words, the blood in that case was a compelled blood test. It wasn't pursuant to an implied consent statute. So don't you have to worry about implied consent as being an exception to the warrant requirement? It was not an issue in McNeely.
Well, actually, Your Honor, the court did deal with the implied consent. In that case, there was an implied consent law, and despite the implied consent law, we found the Fourth Amendment violation. So obviously...
But in that case, did the Missouri law permit forced blood draws?
I don't know if it did or not, Judge.
If it didn't, then wouldn't that be outside the statute?
Your Honor, I don't know whether it did or not, but the bottom line is our implied consent also doesn't allow forced blood draws. And it's the same type of implied consent as they had in that particular case. And despite the implied consent, the court could have said, you know what, there was an implied consent and he consented, therefore it's fine. There's no court that I'm aware of that's ever found a constitutional consent. An implied consent has to be expressed, and all the case law states the same.
Well, counsel, a couple of things. I'd like to understand exactly what point you think McNeely adds to your particular case here, why that case is relevant to your case here. But the other point is, in McNeely, the defendant refused, and then they still took his blood. Isn't that significantly different than this case?
I understand, Your Honor. The reason that McNeely affects this case is, and the significance of it is, that despite an implied consent law, they found a Fourth Amendment violation because of basically a compelled test. So there wasn't consent. And my argument here is, under the Fourth Amendment in the current law, isn't consent either. It's not consent under the Fourth Amendment. It's not consent under Article 1, Section 7. You can't have consent under the Constitution when you tell someone, either do the search or you're going to go to jail for 30 days. That isn't consent under the Constitution.
Well, couldn't it be that the court in McNeely didn't address or didn't consider implied consent as an exception to the warrant requirement because the search in that case wasn't pursuant to that implied consent statute? So there's no reason for them to discuss the statute if the search was done outside the statute. It would be the same situation here if the defendant refused and then the state compelled him, forced him to do a blood test. So don't you get to the McNeely issue only when the police go outside the implied consent statute and do something that's not permitted by the implied consent statute?
As I said, Your Honor, there's no court that I'm aware of that's ever held an implied consent satisfies consent under the Fourth Amendment. The key to this is, prior to McNeely, it was a common understanding that the dissipation created exigency in every case. And because of that, you could have these forced blood draws. You could get into it in that respect, because there was no Fourth Amendment argument. If you could get it under exceptional circumstances, you can't argue otherwise. If you can't get it under exceptional circumstances, it's a search under the Fourth Amendment. You have to have an exception to the warrant requirement, period. An implied consent is not going to supplant Fourth Amendment consent.
So your argument then is that McNeely really is, although the court wrote it as following Schmerber, your argument really is that it changes the Schmerber analysis.
Well, what it does is it narrows Schmerber. if you look at all the cases, in fact, even the Neville case, which talks about Miranda and allowing use of refusals in the case, says, well, we could have got this evidence anyway because it could have been compelled under Schmerber. It was a common understanding that you have this agency in every case. So there's no Fourth Amendment argument. There's an alternate means of getting the evidence. Once you take that away, you have to come up, what is the Fourth Amendment exception to the search here? It's a search.
Can the legislature condition granting the privilege to drive on the driver or the motorist agreeing to certain conditions?
They certainly can, Your Honor. And that's
why can't they condition it on implied consent?
Well, they can. They can make an implied consent. McNeely clearly stated that the states have the opportunity to create implied consent laws and to create penalties under the implied consent law. None of those penalties was a criminal penalty. Privilege, the right to drive is none. It's a privilege. So the state can say, if you want to drive, you have to take the test. And if you don't,
you can say you need to get insurance.
That's correct.
You can say that when you're stopped, you got to produce evidence of your driver's license, your insurance card, your registration. It can impose all kinds of conditions on granting the privilege. So why can't they grant, why can't they condition the privilege on you consenting to permit searches in advance as a condition for driving?
They can in a civil sense where they can take your license. They can't in a constitutional sense where they can put you in jail if you don't grant a constitutional search. The Camara case dealt with that. And incidentally, I think I spelled it wrong in my brief. It's not Camara, it's Camara, C-A-M-A-R-A, not E-R-A. I apologize for that. But that case is an example where the government criminalized the person not allowing a search of their residence. And the court said, you can't do that because people have a constitutional right not to allow Fourth Amendment search. Breath test is a Fourth Amendment search. That's very clear. Everybody agrees to that. Once it's a Fourth Amendment search, you have to have an exception. You can have an implied consent law, and you can still take people's license under a civil context, but you can't say, I'm going to put you in jail unless you consent to this.
Why not?
Because
administrative sanctions impose a burden on consent. Why is it unconstitutional if, in advance of you getting your license, the state is effectively telling you, this is the deal. I'm going to give you your license, but you got to agree that if you get pulled over, probable cause to arrest for drunk driving, you have to consent to a test. And if you refuse, there's criminal sanctions imposed. That's the deal. You want to get your license? If you say yes, why haven't you agreed? Why haven't you waived your right to have a warrant required before a blood test is requested or a breath test is requested?
Again, because driving is a privilege. It's a constitutional right to withdraw your Fourth Amendment consent. The law is clear on that. Even if I say I consent to search my backpack, when you're walking there, I could take it away. While you're unzipping it, I could take it away. That's a constitutional right. It's not a privilege.
What if you want to get onto a military base and they say, as a condition for you getting onto the military base, you have to irrevocably consent that anytime you're on the base, you're subject to search. You go on the base, can you withdraw your consent to search your backpack, or can they search your backpack?
Well, under the federal law, they can certainly do that. That's one of the conditions because of the security around bases. And that's a different issue. Basically, they're not going to send you to jail because you refuse your consent, whereas this is criminalizing your withdrawing your consent. That's the difference here. So you can't criminalize a constitutional right, and there's a constitutional right to withdraw your consent. If a person was on the base and they searched them, and they said no, they're not going to put him in jail 30 days because they said no. That's the difference here. They criminalize it. You can't criminalize. You can create sanctions. You can take away the license, but you can't criminalize the constitutional right to withdraw from your consent.
But in the military circumstance, they could force you to do the search and it'd be lawful. So you're saying they can force you to do the search, but they can't say, they can't impose criminal penalties on it?
That's correct, Judge. And they can force you to take the test or take away your license because it's a privilege. They can't put you in jail for saying you can't search me on a military base. That isn't what the law is. The law is you can search because you've gone in there, but they don't criminalize. That's the difference here. E68 is the difference. Without that statute, the state can impose implied consent. They can take away license. They can penalize people in that respect, but they can't criminalize it. That's the big difference here in the Fourth Amendment. And that's what McNeely changes, because before they could criminalize it, because if you have an alternate means, when you have a per se exception in every case, then why not criminalize it? That's what all the cases, they all are relying on this alternate means. If you already have a means to do it, then you can criminalize it. But if you don't, you can't criminalize it. That's the difference here.
Now, counsel, when I look at your points of error raised in your opening brief, you don't challenge 291E68 as being unconstitutional on its face. And it's only after McNeely, right?
So we
have to buy your argument that McNeely really changes the landscape.
Your Honor, I'm asking for discretionary review. I did not raise it. McNeely came out after the opening brief. It came out 2 weeks before my response brief. And to tell you the truth, Your Honor, I didn't think through all of this until about a month later, because it's not, McNeely doesn't stand for this. It's only through the analysis that I put through in my brief that you come to the conclusions that I have. So it's discretionary. You don't have to.
Right, because McNeely does not deal directly with a question of criminalizing a refusal.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so I'm asking you to do it discretionary. Now, if you choose not to, then we do have the issues in my brief. And those issues are whether there's a Miranda violation as a result of 291E68, whether there's a Wilson violation. And the Wilson violation, I have quite a bit of information. And there's a statute, the 803-9, which is something that needs to be considered. But I think that if you do away with E68, if I'm correct, there's no Miranda violation because the law is clear. When it's civil sanctions, you don't get a lawyer. When E68 is there, then you got to do the Miranda analysis. And under Hawaii law, you have the Williams case. The Williams case says if there's a case where there's not an accident involving injury, the prosecutor has to introduce evidence that the police sat down, had a discussion with this person, and got their consent. That makes that conversation testimonial. That's different than all the law that's cited by the state in their various cases and federal law.
Well, Williams is just a situation in which the predicate for compelling the search, the test in that case, is that there had to be a collision. Isn't that the holding of Williams, is that you analyze whether the statute permits a forced blood draw in a case of an accident involving death or serious injury? That's the Williams case. And the Supreme Court just said, well, there was no collision, no accident, and so you didn't meet the predicate for the forced blood draw. It didn't address the Miranda issue, did it?
No, Your Honor, but the language in that decision says if the state doesn't introduce evidence that the person complied with the statutes and received consent, the exact language is something to effect of non-consensual blood draws are to be suppressed as a fruit of a poisonous tree unless they comply.
Right, but the fruit in that case is not a Miranda violation. The fruit was failure to comply with the predicate of the statute for forcing the search.
You're correct, Judge.
All right, so on the Miranda issue, there are a bunch of states, apparently, that have the same kind of statutory scheme which criminalizes refusal to undergo a test. As far as I can tell, all those cases have found that there is no Miranda implications and no Fifth Amendment violation by that type of scheme. Why am I wrong about that first?
No,
are there cases that say that it is a Miranda violation and there is a Fifth Amendment violation?
You're correct, Judge, but all of those cases don't have the requirement. Ours isn't a implied consent. It's an actual consent. Williams defines, the Supreme Court says it's an actual consent statute unless you're in an accident involving injury. They have to get your consent. That's the difference between all of those cases. So basically, they're all saying you don't have to get consent. It's implied consent, so therefore the conversation doesn't matter. In our case, the conversation matters because that's evidence that must be given to the courts. If it's not, the district court is told that you're going to suppress it. That makes that conversation testimony. That's the key difference between our statutes and everything that they've raised. Once his testimonial obviously is in custody, and obviously the response is a potential incriminating one. And basically, that's the standard in Hawaii for Miranda.
If you're right, and Miranda's required, and the Miranda warning's given, and the suspect asserts his rights, then what happens?
Well, if he asserts his rights, Judge, then they have to get a warrant if they want the evidence. Because basically, that's something McNeely deals with, too, is that the change in technology, and they actually cite the Hawaii statute.
Well, in that case, could they then give them the implied consent warnings?
Well, they could give them the implied consent warnings, and
how
that
would... How could they do that if that's interrogation?
Well, Judge, if they're just dealing with his license, is a different story in a civil context. That evidence couldn't be used in a criminal case, but again, you have a criminal, you have a dual proceeding going on here, so if he refuses, they can take his license. It's just that in the criminal proceedings, it couldn't be used.
So they have to tell him, wait, this is not the, I'm going to ask you more questions, not in the criminal context. This is in the implied consent context, so I'm going to go forward now.
Well, if he asks for a lawyer, the law is clear that whatever he says after that can't be used against him in the criminal case. So they don't have to tell him that. And if they did go forward, it would be up to, obviously, the appellate courts on whether they would allow that in the civil context. At this point, I can't tell you why they... You wouldn't, but that would be obviously an issue to be addressed. But it couldn't clearly be used in the criminal case, because once a person asks for Miranda, everything stops.
So just so I'm clear, you get a situation, we are assuming Miranda applies. Officer advises you have the right to remain silent, and anything you say can and will be used against you. And the arrestee is silent, doesn't say anything in response. And at that point, my question would be, does that constitute a refusal, or is your point, you need to then go get your search warrant?
Well, that's where the stickiness comes in E68, Judge. It creates a whole bunch of havoc that's there, and that's something the courts would have to figure out, you know, because it creates a situation that hasn't been there before. And I think under Hawaii law, if a person's in custody and asks a question, may incriminate them, that's the Miranda standard. It's different than the federal standard. It's different than a lot of states. That's our standard.
Let's say there's no statement back. There's no verbalized statement, and the arrestee simply sits there. Under your Williamson analysis, is that testimonial?
Well, I think that under Williams, if he just sits there, and I don't know how it's going to play out. Follow me, and if you want to blow me, I don't know how. There's a lot of different factors that could play out.
But you can, right? Because any request to take the test is going to be interrogation if Miranda's required.
That's the problem with E68 to begin with.
So effectively, if we impose a Miranda requirement, not only the criminalization basically goes away, but the entire administrative scheme goes away, assuming the defendant asserts his rights.
That very well may be. If E68 is constitutional, then it may be. I mean, that's going to have to be worked in our framework of constitutional law. I mean, the Supreme Court found a violation when a detective talked to someone before they Mirandized them. So it is a very protective constitutional issues in Hawaii, whereas the federal Miranda, when I raised it in court, I never raised a federal Miranda violation because under the federal law, I don't think there would be one.
Are you referring to Neville?
That's correct, Judge. And so I raised it as a purely state constitutional issue when it came to Miranda because of our expansive protection.
But all the other states who have the same statute also have found it to be okay.
But they're all applying these federal standards that are different in Hawaii, and that's the key difference here, is our constitution is different than the other states.
So your argument builds entirely on from Williams.
Well, my argument is that if Williams makes it testimonial, obviously there's a Miranda violation. So it's going to turn on whether it's testimonial or not. That's the whole key to the Miranda argument. If it's not testimonial as the other states, then there's no Miranda violation. If it is, there is. So that's what's going to turn on. Now, there's another reason that you can reverse this that has nothing to do with it, all of those things. That's the Wilson argument. Now, the Wilson argument is because the form tells people that they shall be subject to 30 days unless they take a test. Now, in order to get there, you have to understand the intent of 291E11. 291E11 and 291E15 were separated after the 2006 legislature. Basically, the police and prosecutors lobbied and said, listen, we have to tell people too much on these DUI cases. We want something simple. We want to separate it. And so basically, Act 64, 2006 session changed it. It made 291E11, and then it made 291E15. 291E11 basically says that you don't have to tell any sanctions. You have to say you have a right to take a breath test, you have the right to take a blood test, you have a right to refuse. What do you want to do? If they complied with all of that, there would be no Fourth Amendment issue. There would be no issues here, because basically if my client said, yeah, I'll take a test, it's consent. Now, if you look at the legislative history of Act 64, House Standing Committee Report 76206, if the purpose of this bill is to improve traffic safety by simplifying implied consent requirements of testing a driver for intoxicants. Specifically, this measure will require a law enforcement officer to inform an arrested driver of sanctions that may be imposed for refusing a blood, breath, or urine test only if the person withdraws consent to testing that is implied by operating a vehicle.
So, but your argument is the only reason why the advice was incorrect is because they said you shall be subject to up to 30 days in prison, as opposed to you may be subject to up to 30 days in prison if you're convicted.
That's one of the reasons, Judge. The Hawaii Supreme Court looked at the word shall, and they looked at it in Leslie versus Board of Appeals, 109 Hawaii, 384. And basically, their analysis is the word shall is the same as saying must. So change shall to must. If you don't take a test, you must do 30 days in jail. Now, 291E11, the legislative intent was to not have any sanctions. It didn't tell the police you couldn't give sanctions. But once they give sanctions to one side, they have to give sanctions to everything, because that's what the Wilson line of cases is. You have to make them fully informed. And they can't misinform the person by telling them they're going to go to jail. Guarantee you're going to go to jail unless you take it. That's a very big difference, Judge, telling someone may and shall. And
but the exact wording is shall be subject to up to 30 days in prison. There's an up to in there. So it's not you shall be subject to 30 days in prison, but it's up to 30 days.
That's correct, Judge. It says you shall be.
Doesn't the up to effectively substitute for the may? You know, you're not telling them there's a guarantee of anything. You're saying up to.
Well, Judge, you're telling them they must be subject to up to 30 days in jail. That's incorrect, because
up to doesn't give you a minimum, it just gives you the maximum, right?
That's correct, Judge, but they're telling them they must be, and they're not giving them the other sanctions. If they're going to give them partial sanctions, they have to follow 291E15. 291E15 is specific in giving what sanctions to give. They're giving partial sanctions, one-sided sanctions, and they're taking away the right to refuse this in 291E11.
The obligation to provide all that information only arise once there's a refusal, though? And in this case, your client didn't refuse.
You're right, Judge. That's my point. The obligation only arises. This is what they lobby for, and yet what they do is they put in only the sanctions for refusal. They're not talking about anything else. They could have left it alone, or if they're going to give the sanctions, they have to tell them all the sanctions. You can't give them one-sided.
Point is they're stacking the deck so that they won't refuse.
Right. They're taking away the choice that's
well,
there.
What's the other side that they don't get?
Well, they don't get the E15 tell them they got to tell them about the license sanctions. They got to tell them about the possible jail sanctions. There's a lot of different sanctions that they have to explain to them if they're going to give them sanctions.
And that's right, but there are references to the statutory sanction provisions in the warning, right? 21E65, doesn't the warning itself include the actual...
And sanctions under 291E Part 3. Now, is that something that a person of ordinary understanding would understand? Or are they going to be thinking, I'm going to go to jail 30 days unless I take a test? I mean, the whole purpose in 291E11 is to give them a choice and to tell them what the choices are. And then if they don't do it, then you have this other litany that you have to go through in the 15, E15. So that's the difference. And then finally, there's 803-9. Now, 803-9 is something that I guess nobody really look that closely until we start getting to this E60. Now, 803-9 says that when the police arrest someone for quote-unquote examination, that they shall be provided a lawyer if they ask, or something to that effect. Now, it doesn't tell them you have to tell them that they can get a lawyer, but if they ask for one, they shall be providing them one. Now, the form specifically tells people you can't get a lawyer. And under the old law, they couldn't get a lawyer. Under Williams and E68, a police officer investigating a DUI case is always investigating a potential crime of a person arrested for DUI under E61 is always investigating a possible crime under E68 for refusal. When they arrest a party, Williams tells them that they have to take them to the station. Oh, I'm sorry. My time's up. Right, same for rebuttal.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Nakamura, Judge Fujise, and Judge Kinoza. May it please the court. My name is Robert Nakatsuji. I am a Deputy Solicitor General in the Appellate Division of the Department of the Attorney General. I am representing the Attorney General as amicus curiae in this case. First of all, I'd like to thank the court for allowing me the opportunity to participate in oral argument today. Mr. Vincent graciously agreed to share a portion of his time, and he also asked me to go first. So, with the court's permission, I would like to proceed. Your Honor, I had prepared a presentation to give to the court initially. However, I'd like to depart from that. My presentation pretty much tracked my brief, so I think the court can look at my brief for the detailed arguments on what I think are the main issues in this case. Instead, I'd like to try to address some of the questions that the court raised with Mr. Burge. The court is focusing on certain issues, and in the interest of saving time, I'd like to go right to those issues. First of all, I think the court picked up on the limited nature of the McNeely case. McNeely is actually a very narrow decision. What McNeely actually does, what the actual holding of McNeely is that the per se rule is no longer valid, and the per se rule is the idea that the evanescent nature of blood alcohol evidence, the fact that blood alcohol evidence dissipates in blood, that in and of itself cannot be the sole justification for a search.
Was there a per se rule under Schmerber?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Schmerber is consistent, I think, with McNeely. I think what McNeely does is clarify Schmerber, because I think some courts may have misinterpreted Schmerber. But if you look at Schmerber, Schmerber does talk about limiting the case to its facts. So I think Schmerber actually does, in fact, apply what McNeely is saying it does, which is a case-by-case approach, a totality of the circumstances approach, rather than a per se rule approach. And in fact, if you look at Schmerber, there are other factors there. It's not just the fact that blood alcohol evidence dissipates. The big factor, as I see it in Schmerber, was the fact that there was an accident. And because there was an accident, it would have delayed obtaining a warrant.
But if there's no per se exigent circumstances for a blood draw, doesn't it stand to reason there's no per se exigent circumstances for a breath exam, which you concede is a search?
Yes, Your Honor, I think.
All right, so then exigent circumstances is not going to justify a required breath test in every case. What exception to the Fourth Amendment do you have?
Well, I've cited three exceptions, Your Honor. First is search incident to lawful arrest. And that, in fact, is it can be found in Schmerber.
But if that was the case, why wouldn't McNeely have found the search to be okay under search incident to arrest?
Well, McNeely is a blood draw case. Our case is different. Our case is a blood
right,
case.
But if search incident to arrest justifies a search for that type of evidence, why wouldn't it also justify a search incident to arrest for a blood draw?
I think you have to look at what Schmerber says. Schmerber starts by analyzing the search incident to lawful arrest exception. They cite Weeks versus the United States, which was an early search incident to lawful arrest case. But then the Schmerber court goes on to say that that doesn't apply when there's an intrusion beyond the body surface. And at that point, the court goes into the incident circumstances analysis. So what Schmerber tells me is that in other searches which do not involve intrusions beyond the body surface, search incident to lawful arrest is still valid. And in fact, this analysis, I think, it has been followed. Professor Lefebvre in his treatise talks about this. Also, there are actual cases that have found search incident to lawful arrest. A very important case that I'd like to call the court's attention to is United States versus Reed. That's a Fourth Circuit case. That case, interestingly enough, was a federal drunk driving case. The offenses occurred on the George Washington Memorial Parkway, which is federal property managed by the Park Service. And so these people were arrested and they were subjected to a breath test. And the Fourth Circuit found that those breath tests were valid as searches incident to lawful arrest and as exigent circumstances searches. Reed is also important for a couple of other reasons. Under federal law, refusal is a criminal offense, and the fact that it was a criminal offense did not affect the constitutional analysis. The searches were still valid. Moreover, in Reed, the court could have addressed the consent search issue. Mr. Burge's argument is primarily based on consent arguments. Well, the court in Reed said, you don't have to go there. Breath tests are valid under two other exceptions, so you don't even have to analyze it under consent search. And that is essentially my suggestion to the court. There are three other exceptions that do apply to breath tests, and so there's no reason to get into consent at all. These tests are valid under other exceptions. Now, Mr. Burge also mentioned the Brooks case, Brooks versus Minnesota, and I think the court has to be careful in reading too much into Brooks. Brooks is a Minnesota case, and under Minnesota law, all tests, breath, blood, and urine tests, were valid under the per se rule. The Minnesota court said that the only factor that you need is the evanescent nature of blood alcohol evidence.
And that case wasn't pursuant to an implied consent statute.
I don't know, Your Honor.
I didn't see any reference to the implied consent statute in the case.
I don't know, but I think what we should take from Brooks is that it applied the per se rule, and that's why the judgment was overturned in Brooks. I don't think you can extend that to any kind of broad conclusion that breath tests are categorically invalid for any other reason. I think if you apply a per se rule, then of course you have to deal with McNeely, and you cannot just look at the evidence and nature of what alcohol evidence.
Are you handling the Miranda part of it, or is that Mr. Vincent?
I can address the Miranda part too. You know,
okay, let me ask you my question then. If refusal to submit to a blood draw is a crime, why isn't the question, do you refuse to submit to a blood draw reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response?
Well, Your Honor, there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, the U.S. Supreme Court has already addressed it. In South Dakota versus Neville, the court said that Miranda doesn't apply. Miranda doesn't apply.
That case didn't involve a statute that makes refusal a crime.
True, Your Honor, but the reasoning does apply here. What Neville said was that...
Doesn't making it a crime change the whole character of the question and the response?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think what in the Miranda context, the question is whether it's custodial interrogation.
Interrogation. You concede that he was in custody.
Yes, Your Honor, but I don't think it was interrogation. In fact, that's what Neville says. Asking someone if they're going to comply with a breath test, it's something that's normally attended to arrest and custody. It's not an interrogation. It's not a coerced confession. That's really the purpose of Miranda, to prevent coercion.
Mr. Burge explicitly says he's not relying on Neville. He's not relying on federal case law. He's relying on Williams. And I would ask you also, how would your argument play if you consider Eli and Ketchum, the Hawaii cases that deal with whether there's an interrogation or not?
Well, Your Honor,
so he's not relying on any of Neville or any of those cases that you're talking about. Can you specifically address the Hawaii case law that he's raised?
Your Honor, I haven't really considered the Hawaii implications. I think up to now, I've really been talking about Miranda. So I've been focusing on Miranda. And I think the Miranda issue is settled. But I think you have to look at...
Why is it settled, here, though? When refusal is not a crime, and asking someone, do you refuse, that doesn't lead to the incriminating evidence, because a no doesn't expose you to a crime. But when a no is exposes to a crime, doesn't that change the nature of the question?
Well, Your Honor, I think you have to look at the context here. I think if Miranda is applied to these kinds of tests, I think what's going to happen is defendants everywhere are going to start requesting for attorneys. They're going to start exercising what Miranda provides for. And there are going to be huge consequences there. In these kinds of tests, time is of the essence. The alcohol content is dissipating as you speak. And I think the court has to consider the very practical considerations of applying Miranda or the state constitutional provisions to these kinds of cases. I see that I am out of time, Your Honor, and I want to again thank the court for allowing me to participate, and now I will defer to Mr. Vincent.
Thank you.
Good morning. Brian Vincent. On behalf of the State of Hawaii, the Office of Prosecuting Attorney for State City County. Our position with respect to the Fourth Amendment issue is that implied consent is consent. And it's a bargain that's entered into by the state, between the state and the driver, prior to the defendant ever having been arrested. They're not under suspicion at the time they enter into this agreement. They're not under suspicion at the time they get in their car and drive on the road earlier that evening when they choose to invoke this implied consent bargain. It's a bargain because the state gives the defendant or they give the driver the right to drive the state road system. And the driver in turn gives conditional consent to have a blood draw or a breath test, or breath draw or a blood test, blood draw. In the case, an officer finds that there's probable cause.
So you're basically saying that when you apply for a license, you are effectively giving the state your irrevocable consent to submit to a blood test or a breath exam if you're arrested based on probable cause that you to believe you're driving drunk.
Well, that's correct. And if you look at the application for the State of Hawaii driver's license, it says at the bottom, I agree to submit to a chemical test or test my blood, breath, or urine for purposes of determining alcohol or drug content in my blood when testing is requested by a police officer acting in accordance with Section 291.11.
But Mr. Bird says that under standard constitutional law, someone can always withdraw their consent to a Fourth Amendment search. So why can't they withdraw their consent in this case?
Because in this case, there's a bargain. In the other cases, there's no bargain. And I'll give you an example. One of the cases he cites was involved. A police officer pulled over a gentleman for a traffic violation. Asked him for his ID, did a quick background check, found that he had some gun violations and so forth. Asked him to search. Ask him if you'd consent to search his car. Right? The driver said yes. The officer said, "Go stand over there, 50 feet away. Turn your back." Okay. And I think the Court of Appeals, the Federal Court of Appeals, in this case, found that they didn't give that the defendant or the arrestee a meaningful chance to delimit his search of the car. Okay. But that's a case where the arrestee is essentially giving the right to search the car as a gift. Okay, it's like one of those contracts where your uncle says, when you're 18, I'll send you on a trip to Europe. Okay, and you get to 18, and you say, well, I'm 18, send me a trip to Europe. He says, well, I changed my mind. Okay. You have a right to do that under contract law, okay, providing there's no reliance on the contract and so forth, okay? But when you have a contract in which both sides have given consideration, both sides are bound by this contractual obligation.
Mr. Vincent, when you read the form there, number one, I'm not sure if that's in the record. Is it in the record?
I think the court could take judicial notice of that. Well,
let's assume we can take judicial notice of it if it's in the record. What I didn't hear was that if you refuse, it's a crime. Is that in the form?
This one does not say that, yeah. And I catch it as a link into my supplementary brief, so you can take a look at the form if you want. My point goes beyond, I mean, I think this is, I mean, it gives most people who have driven on the road have read this, right, and then they've given their consent, right? But this applied consent law applies to even people who have not got a driver's license, people from other states, okay? It's essentially, you get on the road, you agree to the contract.
And that was fine when the sanction was you could lose your license. The question is where you criminalize now the refusal to submit.
Well, I don't think the criminalization of the refusal changes the equation, because once you've entered into that implied consent contract with the state, you don't have a right to refuse to take a blood test anymore.
So is your point then, for that reason alone, we should ignore the possibility of Miranda rights?
I mean, right now I'm arguing the Fourth Amendment issue. Okay. I have another reason for the Miranda.
Okay, so your Fourth Amendment analysis is because at the get-go, when you get your license, you basically irrevocably consent to a breath or blood test, and therefore you have no right to refuse. So if you have no right to refuse, there's no problem with the state criminalizing something you have no right to do.
That's correct.
Okay.
The statute says that if I don't know exactly word. I don't have the words in it. They like where the statute, but it says that if you choose not to take a test, no test will be given. Okay. I would argue that this is a command to the police officers. If do not give forcible blood draws. Okay. That's the bottom line. I don't think it gives a right to the defendant to refuse to take a breath of blood test when there's probable cause to do that.
All right, maybe I can turn you to the Miranda issue. I'll ask the same question.
Okay.
All right. If refusing to submit is a crime, why isn't the question, will you submit, interrogation, reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response?
Well, first of all, what the statute, I believe, really criminalizes is the failure to provide a blood sample, not a statement that I'm going to refuse, that I'm not going to give a blood sample. It's the refusal to provide the evidence voluntarily. That's a criminal act, not the statement, I'm not going to take the blood test. Okay? So I don't think it's a statement. My position, it's not a statement in the sense that it's a criminalizing statement. If the officer had probable cause to arrest you for something, burglary, whatever, and they went down and they tried to take fingerprints of you and struggled and refused to get fingerprints, you would be charged with resisting arrest. And there's a criminal penalty for that. And nobody suggests that the person has a right to refuse to give.
But doesn't it complicate the matter that the refusal itself is a crime?
I don't think so. I don't think it changes the analysis, because the analysis is their interrogation, not whether or not what the consequences for refusing to provide the physical evidence.
All right, and what is a test for interrogation?
The test for interrogation is whether or not it's reasonably likely to induce an incriminating response. And I think that's misleading, because I don't think that, I think that's a misleading formulation of the rule, because Fifth Amendment was always intended to prohibit coerced statements. Okay, it was Miranda is to keep the officers from putting so much coercive, unduly coercive pressure on the defendant. defendant to confess, that they will give potentially a false statement, okay, for a false confession, right? This is not a, for, first of all, the officer is not, does not want them to refuse, okay? The officer wants them to take the test. That's the whole point of the refusal statute. So
how do you know that, though? I mean, not now the refusal to submit to the test is, can be punished with more jail time than a DUI conviction.
Well,
so you're trying to read the, you're asking us to read the mind of the police officer that they'd rather have a DUI conviction than a refusal to submit conviction?
I don't know about the police officer, but I know the legislature wants to stop refusals. I mean, that's the point. I mean, I guess studies have shown that, surveys indicate that about 10% of people refuse to take the breath and blood test when they're arrested. So the legislature wants to put an end to that. Okay, some states have taken the option that they just provide expedited search warrants, and they take forcible blood draws. Okay, Louisiana, Texas, California, about 10, 11 states that permit forcible blood draws. Okay, Hawaii has taken what I believe is a reasonable approach and said that, well, okay, we're not going to take forcible blood draws, but we're going to provide for a little bit harsher penalty if you don't submit to provide a sample.
Well, irregardless of our statute and the amendment criminalizing refusal, if they got a warrant, they could do
that's
that.
True. Mm-hmm. Right? That's true. I guess that's the option if we were to find that this is a 291-168. Constitutional for some reason. We could go to the legislature and ask for them to provide for, allow police officers to do search warrants. But I don't see how that protects the defendant's rights.
On that line, if I may, if you assume that Miranda rights are implicated as a result of the criminalization of the refusal, practically speaking, can that work? Can that, so as I mentioned earlier, you have somebody in custody, you've given the Miranda warnings, and they're silent. What then?
That's a problem. Vermont allows by statute a right to appointed counsel before you're asked this question. And it's caused a number of problems. Well, these two that I know. One is that the PDs don't always like to come out at 2 o'clock in the morning to advise, OVUI arrestees, that they should take the test, right? Because they're ethically bound not to advise defendants to do something unconstitutional, right? Or unlawful, right? So the only thing that the PDs can really tell them is take the test, which is what the form already tells them.
Going back to the interrogation, why isn't the no testimonial?
Because it just indicates so that was the third thing. Also, confessions or Miranda almost always applies to past events. When a person interrogation is usually about something that happened in the past. Did you kill X? Did you do this? Steal whatever? Okay, this is something that's going to happen in the future. Okay? Usually, that's not the subject matter of confession, okay? Except perhaps an attempted statute. Where
what I'm hearing you saying, though, you gave me policy reasons why the interrogation. Typical interrogation test shouldn't apply in the circumstance, but you're not really answering why it isn't interrogation of the classic definition of interrogation.
Well, the case that I cited, the Flores case, the first Florida Court of Appeals case, basically found that it was not interrogation under their standard. I think that they use the same formulation, but again, they qualify it to be with respect to a past confession and so forth. Something where the officer actually intends to.
Right. They said it was an interrogation, but they really didn't explain why the question wouldn't reasonably likely be elicit an incriminating response?
I mean, essentially, yeah. I mean, you give the example. What if the person just remains silent and just says?
Or it says, I refuse to speak. You told me I don't have to speak. I refuse.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
I'm not going to talk to you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a refusal, even though he doesn't say anything. So I don't think that that's contemplated to be a confession or a coerced statement that would, you know, fit the classical definition of interrogation.
Is there any case under the Hawaii case law that would indicate that there's some kind of exception to police mandated instructions or some other exception that other jurisdictions have relied upon, that the Hawaii courts have relied upon in analyzing whether something is interrogation subject to Miranda?
I'm not aware of any particular case. I don't know if through a particular case or not, but I think I don't know if I can answer that question. I don't believe I wasn't aware. I'm not aware of anything that helped me in coming to this conclusion. Can I just return quickly to McNeely question? Since McNeely came out, and if you do a key site of McNeely, you'll come up with a list of cases that referred to it. One of them was Delaware Superior Court. I don't know if this is a citable case or not, but in that case, basically, it's state beef finder, you can find yourself request a search. It said that McNeely didn't change the analysis with regard to implied consent. Implied consent is still consent. Okay? Delaware doesn't criminalize refusal. So that in that respect, that case is very similar to Severino, which is the case you rely on, because Severino says you don't have enough right to an attorney. And I think implicitly it said it's not unduly constitutional, because it says implied consent laws are well established in this state. One that does is right on point is this case of Minnesota versus Brooks, which brought to my attention in this brief. And the reason why that case is very similar to our case is because in Minnesota, the refusal to submit a breath blood test is a criminal offense, breath blood or urine in this case. Is a criminal offense, and in Minnesota versus Brooks, the state raised two reasons why the urine test in that case was not excludable. In that case, okay, first of all, in that case, Minnesota has a refusal statute that criminalizes refusal. And they also, in this case, defendant, like in this case, voluntary, did not refuse to give a urine sample. Okay. State raised two reasons why it should not be suppressible. One was that it was not unduly coerced. There was already implied consent. Okay. The Minnesota Court of Appeals basically declined to answer that issue, okay, and said, "Okay, we're just going to address it under the exigent circumstances, and under our case law, we're bound to find that there is exigent circumstances." Well, of course, under McNeely, that Brooks was sent back down to be reconsidered in case of Neely. Okay, almost immediately, the Minnesota Supreme Court accepted accelerated review of that case. So it's going to be addressed, I think, approximately the same doctrinal circumstances is going to be addressed by the Minnesota Supreme Court, hopefully within the next 6 months or so. It's interesting. There's two cases, actually. They were both consolidated together.
Mr. Vincent, has the defense preserved for our review the question of whether the criminalization of the refusal is constitutional or not? And the question I asked Mr. Burge earlier, which is, they didn't raise it in their opening brief initially. They only raised it after McNeely was issued by the U.S. Supreme Court. Was the question of the constitutionality of the criminalization raised at all below?
I don't know. I'm saying no.
Okay. Well, that's fine.
I understand why you didn't raise it.
Let me ask you, what is your position on that?
Well, my position is just from a practical, we'd like this issue decided sooner than later.
Okay, thank you.
So. if you consider that.
I have a question on the Miranda. So if Miranda was required, obviously he didn't get a Miranda warnings in this case, would the breath test in this case be suppressible as a fruit of the Miranda violation? Is there any, in other words, assuming we find there was a Miranda violation, do you have any argument as to why the breath test results would not be a fruit of that violation?
I think Stady Wilson makes it kind of difficult for us because the form says you have no right to return. And it seems like to me Wilson says that, you know, if you tell them something, it better be accurate. Okay? If it's not accurate, then I'm not sure. We're a little bit shaking around, I think, as far as having complied with statutory requirements, I guess, statutory requirements and requirements of Wilson with respect to whether or not
So the answer is no, you don't have any good argument as to if we find that there's a violation, that there's some kind of fruit exception to this thing, or I'm asking if you have any argument on that.
I think I have a good argument, but it's the dissenting argument, Wilson. So that's not, unfortunately, binding precedent. It's not.
You may have to address that at the next level.
That's right. That's correct, Your Honor. And I intend to do that. With respect to the, I think the defendant feels that the form is confusing. With respect to the shall be subject to up to, I think, Your Honor, I think a person of common understanding would understand that that means that they may be subject to up to.
Right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have another hour, but I have 5 minutes, Jess.
All right.
Basically, I wanted to quickly address the three exceptions raised by the Attorney General. First, search incidental to arrest. The key here is, U.S. Supreme Court said that a breath test is an inner body search. They said that in Skinner versus Railway, where they say subjecting a person to a breathalyzer test, which generally requires production of ablar or deep lung breath for chemical analysis, implicates similar concerns about body integrity. And like the blood test we considered in Schmerber, should also be seen a search. Now, it's measuring something in their body. Now, inner body searches have been found different than outer body searches, as the AG pointed out. And Schmerber talks about that. The Hawaii Supreme Court adopts that under Article 1, Section 7, State versus Clark, 65 Hawaii 488. They basically say there has to be exigent circumstances in order to get an inner body search. So if you find it's an inner body search is incidental to arrest is out. McNeely, applying in general, takes out exigent circumstances. They also raise the special police means, or let me see the exact, special needs. Special needs is also out because special needs does not apply in cases that are designed to uncover evidence of ordinary criminal wrongdoing. And that was the City of Indianapolis versus Edmond, 531 U.S. 32, involving a drug interdiction checkpoint. They found because the purpose is to find drugs as opposed to getting people off the streets, it violates that.
Mr. Birch, I'm sorry. If I could ask you
yes,
to go back to your interbody search question.
Yes, Judge.
I'm not clear if you made the point that a breathalyzer test specifically has been found to constitute interbodies.
I did raise the same in my brief. I used the language from the Skinner case. I know that the AG is pointing out there is a case, the Reed case, and there's the Anchorage case, both of them finding this, but none of them address the inner body search aspect of breath tests. Of course, it's a more reasonable search, but if it's an inner body search, that's off the table totally, and that's according to a whole body of cases that I've cited. So, and then there's one more, Ferguson versus City of Charleston, 532 U.S. 67, which also says special needs doesn't apply when you're getting specific, targeting specific wrongdoing, which is what you'd be doing here, trying to get evidence in a DUI case when you suspect that's what you're doing. So it's not a special needs exception. There is no exception to the warrant requirement, and the only exception they can do is consent, and it's not consent when you tell somebody that you shall be subject to 30 days in jail, no more than it's consent to search anything else, telling them that they're going to go to jail unless they adhere to it. And to the court's question regarding fruit of the poisonous tree, if you do find a Miranda violation under the Hawaii law, it's a fruit of the poisonous tree, and evidence is suppressed under Hawaii law as a fruit of the poisonous tree for a Miranda violation, whereas, of course, under the federal law in other states, it's not. So it would be suppressible under that as well.
It's clear that any court that has addressed the criminalization of the refusal, that the courts have found them constitutional.
That is correct, Judge. And those were all pre-McNeely cases as well, though.
So your point is back to McNeely.
I think that changes the landscape. There's going to be a whole body of law coming out, and perhaps this court will be part of it. But
McNeely doesn't really affect the Miranda issue, right? I mean, it's a different issue.
No, it's a different issue, Judge. You're right.
And all the courts who have looked at it.
I'm sorry, you were asking Miranda. You're correct. Under federal law is different than under the state law. Our constitution... And are you in custody? Are you asked a question that may elicit an incriminating response? You tell me no, I'm going to arrest you for refusal. As the judge said, you can go to jail more for refusing than you can for the original DUI in a first, second, not third, but first or second offense. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. We'll take the case under submission.
All right.
Quarter.